Ashdown Forest podcast. This episode is all about children and nature.
That was 8-year-old James, and you'll be hearing from him later. And welcome now from me, Eka Morgan, and from Tom Forward, our wildlife guide.
Hello.
So, Tom, I want to start us off today with playing you a clip of an interview I recorded a few years ago with a man who grew up in the 1930s near the Ashdown Forest, Peter Kirby. And this is what he said to me a few years ago.
In the summer holidays, we'd make it so that we lived off what we could get, whether it be catch a fish, cook it, go and nick a swede out of a field. Willow, chew on bits of willow, because they're quite tasty. I mean, at the right time of year, you can find the nuts and everything, but, you know, just to stave off the pangs of hunger, I'd just chew on anything. So we didn't have to go home and spoil the fun we were having.
Tom, did you chew on bits of willow to stave off the pangs of hunger?
It wasn't willow for me, but I do remember nibbling on sorrel leaves. I used to call them vinegar leaves.
How do you think Peter's roamings compared to yours? He grew up in the 1930s and 40s. You grew up in
the 70s.
The 70s. And, you know, they say that in the 1920s, the average roaming distance for an 8-year-old could be up to 6 miles.
Well, I don't think my roaming distance was quite as far as Peter Kirby's, but almost certainly between 1 and 2 miles from home. And I was lucky enough to be able to often do that without even having to cross a road.
Would you have been on your own some of the time, or always with friends?
Both. Sometimes it was just nice to go for a little wander, and I had my peculiar interests, which not everybody else was into.
Such as?
Well, catching grasshoppers, you know, that's not everybody's bag. Watching a kestrel's nest at the top of a pine tree and spending hours just seeing the parents come and go and the chicks begging.
What about your own children who were born in the 2010s?
Well, our home is at the edge of a copse that belongs to the forest, and the boys can let us know that they're heading off, and we'll give them a time to come back, and they've got trees to climb, dens to build, sticks to play with, anywhere between 50 to 200-300 yards from the house.
That is a huge reduction compared to you. How comfortable would you be with them going up to 1 and 2 miles?
The difference now is that they would need to cross a road, a really busy, fast road. And the same road was there when I was a kid, but wasn't nearly as busy. And I just don't feel my kids are that well road trained yet.
And now I've got another clip to play you. And it's from The Diary of a Young Naturalist by Dara McNulty from Northern Ireland, which he wrote when he was 16, and he won the Wainwright Prize for Nature Writing for it in 2020. And he's now beavering away at Cambridge studying natural sciences, and he's given us permission to include this edited extract from his book, which is read now by the Ashdown Forest local 16-year-old Louis Carter.
Friday, the 12th of October. A young boy of about 6 is playing in the forest, enjoying the fallen, russet leaves crunched beneath his feet. A breeze is blowing gently, and while he rummages, he finds a conker. The boy pushes it from its spiked casing and holds it up, and the conker shines, a tiny glove of red-tinted light. The boy's mum notices, glances up from her phone, and now she's charging in and snatching the conker. Dirty, she proclaims, and hurls it away. The boy is crestfallen. A light goes out. As I watch, anger surges inside. I think about all these tiny wrongdoings, everywhere, in every season, the tiniest crimes, the things grown-ups do without thinking. What's so wrong with the conker? I breathe and rise from the bench where I was watching the thrushes in the trees. I go into the pile of leaves myself to start searching, and it doesn't take long to find one. Round, swollen, so perfect. When I hold up the conker to the light, the little boy comes over and his eyes dare to shine a little. I pass it to him. Put it in your pocket, I say. It's called a conker. It's a seed of that horse chestnut tree.
So I should say that there are many staggeringly eloquent passages in Dara's book which are about the joy of nature. It's just that this scene really stayed with me about our separation from nature. Do you recognise anything from that scene?
Sadly, I do. I had a moment that I will never forget, which is a strong echo of what we've just heard, which was taking a school group out on the South Downs. we were in a beautiful bit of chalk grassland, the sun was shining, and I said, come, let's just sit down and enjoy this. And the response was, oh, I don't want to sit down here, it's dirty. That really stuck with me.
So how separate do you think we have come from nature?
Well, so separate that I feel like I've had to devote my life to trying to help build bridges with children and with their parents as well. But when you do capture the imagination or spark that bit of interest, it is the most rewarding thing.
So later in this episode, we have Rich Skrine, who's written three different 50 Things to Do books. One is 50 Things to Do in the Wild, one is 50 Things to Do in the Snow, and one is 50 Things to Do with a Stick. What did you do with a stick as a child growing up on the forest?
Well, sticks present endless opportunities, and on a cold winter's day, launching a big stick onto a frozen pond is bliss. It skids along, it makes an amazing sound. We use sharpened hazel sticks to make spears, sticks obviously for dam building, for holding flags on the top of, roasting sausages over a fire. It's unlimited, like he says.
I'm glad you mentioned the fire, because we must say that no fires are allowed on the forest. And when Rich, later in the programme, mentions making fires, that's in a forest school setting, not on the Ashdown Forest.
Wow. I'm just being blown away by this huge flock of... It's a fizzing flock, is the only way to describe it, of siskins and redpolls over our heads. This feels like pre-migration chatter and energy. You don't expect to see them in the springtime in those dense flocks. That's a kind of winter phenomenon, but we're right at the cusp of transferring into the spring season, and so this is a bit of a kind of...
Last hurrah.
Last hurrah, exactly.
And they're on their way...
They'll be heading off to Scandinavia. That's what the forest delivers every time.
And Chris Packham, the TV presenter and naturalist, says there's not only a loss of biodiversity, there's a near extinction of young naturalists. What do you think we can do to inspire a new generation of young naturalists?
It needs to come off the page and be rooted in the practical. We need to be out there, hands-on, observing the seasons, the patterns in nature up close.
Well, this is the perfect moment for me to give an update. For loyal listeners may remember that in episode 5, we spoke to Mary Colwell, who was telling us about her 11-year battle to get a natural history GCSE approved. Mary thinks it's going to be a total game changer in young people's understanding of the natural world. And in April this year, that's 2024, there will be a public consultation, which is a chance for anyone to comment on the proposed content of the GCSE on the Department for Education website. Is that something you'll be commenting on, Tom?
For sure. The biggest thing in all of it is to guarantee good field time. That's where the real learning happens, and you reinforce it back in the classroom. But, you know, a subject like this needs to have lots of dedicated time in the field.
So finally for now, Tom, do you have any tips for parents to inspire children to connect to nature more?
One thing, nettles. They're just flushing at the moment, and we all know what they are, and if you don't, you'll be stung by the one, and then you know what it is. But they support a whole host of other wildlife, and keep an eye out for tiny, spiky black caterpillars. These are the larvae of the peacock butterfly, and if you keep an eye on that nettle patch, you can see almost the whole life cycle of this beautiful butterfly play out.
I was not expecting such a specific example as that. And have you got some more tips?
The other one that I find myself doing regularly when out and about is arrive at a place which feels just right. It's a nice tree, it's a log to sit on, and I stop and I go quiet and I just try to be. And then all of a sudden, it sometimes takes a few minutes, things come alive around you that you would not have been aware of were you just ploughing on through.
Similar to that, some people have a sit spot. They know that spot and they go as regularly as possible and they really just watch the changes of the seasons there in that spot, and then they know it really well.
Yeah, and don't write off the familiar. There is always change, we can rely on that. And being in a familiar place allows you to be relaxed and more at ease and better appreciate what is going on around you. That is lesser-spotted woodpecker. I know where we're going now.
Are you sure it's lesser?
100%. We had both at the same time and they're completely different. Yeah!
Should we just go towards that?
Yep. We've got a little bit closer, but it's still fairly distant, that sound. We might just be able to hear the sound of a gill stream in the background. That's one of our clues. They love a bit of wet woodland. But this bird, year after year, is disappearing, is vanishing from our woodlands. And that it's still here on the forest is a testament to how special this place really is.
So what I'll do is I'll bring up a recording I have of the lesser-spotted woodpecker so people can hear it. And I seem to remember that although lesser, they have a longer drill than the greater. Is that
right? Yep, and both male and female will duet drum together.
Thank you so much, Tom, and see you later for the dusk recording.
See you at dusk.
This is the best time of my life! I love playing in the mud!
My name's Murray and I'm 9 years old. I usually invite my friends around quite a lot to go out in the woods, build dens, play army, get dirty, and embrace ourselves with the nature.
I'm Alice, I'm 9 years old, and I really like the outdoors. I can be myself. It makes me feel free and like I'm not captive. You can go anywhere, there's no limits. Parents like to stick to the path, and I like to go into a different way. And it's just like me more than anything.
I'm Andre. My age is 9. I don't go outdoors that often. I just fancy staying inside so I could play my video games.
My name is James and I am 9 years old. I'm here at Ashton Forest right now. There's animals everywhere. I saw a couple today. I saw birds, robins. I unclogged a little stream. Thanks to me, it all connects to a massive river now. I want to work here when I'm older.
I'm Josh and I'm 9 years old. When I'm outdoors, I like to dive into the long grass. Sometimes I lie down and look at the clouds, what they look like and how fast they're moving. And I like the deer that are in Ashton Forest because I like the spots that some of them have and I like the colours.
I'm Miss Wilson. I'm the Year 4 TA for this Class 4 trip, and it's so different seeing them outside in the open compared to the classroom. They're all quite fidgety, they can't sit still for long, and they get told off for it. And out here, they're just free. They're able to be the kids that they want to be without nagging them and pulling them down. And it's lovely. And we have a kid in our class with severe ADHD, and he's got autism too. And he can be disruptive. He has to go out of the classroom a lot because if he has trouble regulating his emotions. He's just been able to be himself. He's been able to be at the front of the queue. He's been the first person to be stuck in. He's just really like Mother Nature's child out here. The amount of them I've heard say that they want to come back with their parents, they just love it.
It's so great to be in mud. It's so great to be in mud. It's so great to be in mud. It's so great.
I'm now in the quarry near the Ashdown Forest Centre, and I'm with Lisa Stevens and Paula Dallouche, who've both been working in outdoor education since the 1990s, and they are the education team here at the Ashdown Forest Centre. So to start off, as this is a double act, can I hear how each of your love of the natural world began? Lisa, let's start with you.
I think it's just kind of walking out with my family. I grew up on Epsom Downs and we'd just go for walks and just noticing what was going on out and about.
And Paula?
Very similar, just wandering off as a very young child in the countryside and finding solace and fun and everything.
So children and young people visit the forest here from the ages of 2 to up to 18, though I think your most frequent sessions are primary school.
Yeah,
children. Yeah. So could you describe a classic session with primary schools?
A lot of our work is about kind of curriculum-focused stuff. So they'll come to do perhaps a Winnie the Pooh session where lots of it's about sensory exploring. It's kind of getting outside, getting their hands dirty, touching the trees, you know, rubbing their hands in the mud, those kind of things that they're just kind of exploring. So they've got something to take back to school to develop on, really.
It's immersive for them to learn that
part
of the curriculum.
Yeah, that's the key of all our sessions, isn't it? They're just really getting in and amongst it and noticing it. Really trying to get children just to look for themselves. What do they see? What do they notice?
It starts to make sense why they're learning it as well, because it's real life, and then it becomes so enjoyable. They're wondering to themselves why they're not learning like this all day, every day.
And could you describe one of your games that goes down best?
I quite like the sensory games that we do down here especially. So we might take one of their senses away, so they become hypervigilant with their touch or hearing. We might use a blindfold here or there. That sounds a bit odd, but we do, because then they focus in on sounds and touch and each other. So they have to rely upon each other to help them.
Yeah, and then there's a game that I play loads, which we call Deer, that really is, I'll walk at the front, you give them a sign, the deer antlers usually on the top of the head, and they have 3 seconds just to step to the side of the path and be hidden. They just love that. I love it. You turn around, you can't really see them, and suddenly they all emerge from behind the trees. It just gets me every time. I just like it makes me giggle.
And I've seen you do one where they're rolling around in the heather. What's that one?
That's kind of like some schools come to look at Stone Age, and it's a really amazing place. Just to, you can feel like you're living how people did in Stone Age times. They try out a heather mattress, so they'll lie on the heather and just see how bouncy and springy it is and get a sense of, because that was gathered up and brought inside for mattresses in the past. So I think that's what we were doing there.
I think the other thing I really like is that we encourage questions. So if someone stops and asks a question, it's always something you can elaborate on.
I was going to ask you about curiosity and whether over the decades you've been doing this outdoor work, have you seen children's curiosity stay much at the same heightened level, or because so many children are in front of screens, is there any sense of they're less curious now?
I think they're slightly apprehensive when they arrive with curiosity, but not at the end, funnily enough.
I don't think children have got less curious. I think that's one of the things we're quite good at, isn't it? That is actually being interested in children's questions and wanting to stop and look at what they show you. And if somebody's taking that interest, then I can't say that I've seen that they're less curious.
Well, yeah, we're always excited if they roll a log over and there's a squeal or something. We're just as excited as them. So we come rushing over and we're like, oh, let me have a look. Let's see what's there.
And do you think a few decades ago, or perhaps a bit more than a few decades ago, a lot of the activities that you're doing with these children outside, they would have done on their own when they were left to their own devices? What I mean is, are you almost managing their play or at least supervising it?
I think we're allowing it more because there seems to be like a direct, almost DNA thing where someone will bang a stick, someone will throw a rock in the sea or something like that. It's inherent within, it's all natural movement. I just think that they haven't been able to do that. So we just see them naturally do age-old things that's within
sometimes
them.
Sometimes I think actually parents inhibit it because it's the parents that, you know, quite often children have said, oh, my mum's going to kill me for getting this muddy. And I'm like, no, it's fine. We told them before you came.
And have you seen any signs of fear of the natural world?
Yes. Yeah, that's something you have to ease into. It's dirty. It's a spider.
Yeah, spiders and wasps are probably the thing, aren't they? Yeah. They do get a squeal turning out. Yeah, spiders probably.
Slugs.
Adders? What about adders?
That's an interesting one because they squeal with excitement and fear simultaneously and want to find one.
Some groups just get off the coach and all they can talk about is adders. All they want to see is an adder. They've heard about that. Yeah, well, I'd love to find more adders for schools.
Do you ever have to calm slightly destructive tendencies where some of the children feel a kind of dominance over nature?
Yeah, that happens sometimes.
I don't know what it's about, but people do snap bits off plants. They'll snap off branches and things. So, you know, I have quite a few times kind of been going, no, that tree's still alive. It might not look like it's alive, but it is. So I don't know what that's about. I don't really know.
It's but, interesting if you just sort of say, what are you doing that for? And then they're like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe don't do that again then.
Conversely, do you think that spending time in nature inspires gentleness towards the natural world?
I think what it can do is it can reduce a bit of anxiety if they're feeling slightly destructive for whatever reason, and so many nowadays, that being outside in an open space with stretch your eyes and there's calming noises and space to breathe, it can have a remarkable effect on calming people down.
On one of my visits, the TA, the teaching assistant, said to me that one of the children had ADHD and autism, but out here, he was not only totally focused, he was also often the first to solve the tasks. Do you see that quite a lot?
Virtually every class is like that.
So before a visit, the teachers will kind of let us know if there are any children with behaviour issues. But often, during the day, that doesn't show up. We don't know which those children are. The teachers do, and they're keeping an eye on it. But, yeah, I'll get to the end of the day and go, well, which ones were the ones with behaviour issues? I can't, you know, you very often don't see them. You don't notice them. Because in this environment, they just have a chance to kind of excel, where they perhaps don't in the classroom.
That's such an advert for children having a permanent outdoor classroom.
It's going to suit some children, isn't it? It's not going to suit everyone, but they're, I guess, some people's brains kind of more click into the practical problem solving, seeing the real life problem in front of them.
So you were saying the muddier the better, really, and I've read Chris Packham, the TV presenter and naturalist, say children need to get slimed, scratched, bitten and stung to ignite a spark and find a love of nature. What do you think?
It's a bit harsh. I mean, some of the best nature I've loved is just sitting down and having a stare.
I definitely think you've got to get muddy. You've got to get wet. You've got to just be out in it all. Perhaps it's about actually spending enough time. If you spend enough time in nature, then you are going to get muddy, wet, stung, scratched. And perhaps that's what it's about in a way. And I do think that it is about having enough opportunities to get out.
Well, given that now we hear that both children and adults spend less than 5% of their time, this is in the industrialised West, outdoors, what do you think are the barriers, let's say, to parents inspiring their children to get outside more and connect to nature?
There is this culture at the moment where your parents might feel that they've got to permanently entertain. It's like, what are we going to do? Is it boring? We're only going to visit the Ashdown Forest if there's an event going on or something like that. And actually, there's no need to entertain a child permanently. There is a need to allow that child to entertain themselves a little bit more. And I don't think you can be creative and curious without a little touch of boredom, aka thinking time. And that might be a barrier because we're overstimulated, and so are they.
Oh, the families are so busy as well, though, aren't they? There's so little time. I think adults have got so many things to do that feels like the biggest thing is actually getting out.
The other thing is, if you haven't got time, you know what they say, you've got to slow down. And there seems to be more time as well when you slow down.
Very deep.
Well, it's true.
And what's your tip for children who point blank refuse to go outside?
Take a friend. Mm. I think that's the thing, and that's sometimes why the school is so joyous, because they've got their friends there. Mm. I know it's like, I struggle to get my children to go out for a walk, but if you meet a friend, then that's easy.
It's a great tactic. Or take your granny. I think the biggest hurdle is getting out the house. And as soon as you're out, everything else will just fall into place.
And you can kind of go, you could kind of say just go to loads of different places, and that's nice to go and see different places. But there's something really amazing, isn't there, about knowing one place really well. That's one of the things that gets me up here. You know where things are going to come up, and you know where the bluebells are, and you know where to go and look for the tiger beetles. And I love that. Mm. I love that kind of, I suppose it's that slowing down again. Mm. Just noticing what you see, noticing what changes.
Kids love coming back and knowing what's around the corner and telling each other. There's a bit of an ownership then, where you start to look after the place. So it works in that way as well. Have more respect for it.
Thank you so much, Lisa and Paula. Before we end, please can you both tell me the wildlife sound that you would like to play out after this interview? Paula.
Oh, I think mine's going to be a skylark. I'll drift off to my happy place if I hear skylarks. Don't always see them, but you can definitely hear them.
And Lisa?
Okay, perhaps just the call of a buzzard that you kind of stops you in your tracks and makes you look up. And you can actually get to see them often, which so many birds vanish before you do. So I love a buzzard.
And actually, referring back to episode 3 of the podcast, there's an amazing moment where Tom spots a jay imitating a buzzard, which is almost as good as the real buzzard. So do listen back to episode 3 for that. And thank you so much both again.
Pleasure.
Oh, it's been fun.
I'm Anya, I'm 16, and I've recently started volunteering with the Ashdown Forest Youth Group. And I started because I wanted to be part of a group that actively helped the heathland and the forest. As I've grown up, I've been able to see more and more species of birds and kind of build up a repertoire. So every time you see a new bird or hear about a new bird, it's quite cool to add it to your list. We see foxes quite a lot, which is quite cool. And I'd also like to see a hedgehog in the wild, because I've never seen a wild hedgehog. I saw a newt for the first time this week, which was very cool.
So what do you say to friends or people you know who say nature's boring, it's a bit uncool? How do you enthuse them?
My phone is filled with pictures of stuff, so I think showing them stuff that I've seen, but also I guess if you can link it to something that's important to them, because I think nature's connected to so many things that if you can find something that they're interested in and then link it back to that, then you might be able to find some way of making it important to someone else as well.
So I've just come across, what's your name?
George.
George and?
Alex.
Alex. And George, Alex and?
Charlie.
Charlie are felling quite a substantial Scots pine. And, well, can you describe what you're doing? Shall I start with you, Alec?
Yeah, so we're clearing the heath so it doesn't kind of turn back into forest. And so we're cutting down the Scots pines, which are kind of really invasive and are kind of all over the place when they really shouldn't be. And so, yeah, Charlie over here is helping cut down this tree.
And you've learned how to do a mouth cut?
Yeah.
So what is a mouth cut?
You just cut it at, like, an angle, like a beak. And then it will land in the direction that you did it.
Ah!
It's just...
There
timber.
It goes!
Oh,
In
the right direction. Okay, yeah, well, let's walk right. over to Charlie as well and hear how satisfied Charlie is. Well done. Oh, you are actually, that broke you into a sweat.
Yeah.
Do you feel you did that single-handedly, or did Alex
I say Alex, George, moral support. Alex put in a lot of the work. He cut out the special thing to make it fall the right way.
Okay. And I'll ask all of you, Charlie, what drew you to signing up to be a youth volunteer?
DV and love of nature.
And what is the origin of your love of nature?
Parents bring me out for walks all the time.
And did they drag you out to nature, or did you go willingly?
Half the time was dragged, but it was worth it.
Brilliant. What about you, Alex? What drew you to sign up to these groups?
Sort of like Charlie said, we're all a group of us doing this as part of our Duke of Edinburgh Award. But also, I've grown up with this, and so just coming back here and be able to do some conservation work on it's really nice.
George?
Yeah, I really like nature. It's just such a treat, isn't it? You go out on walks and... yeah, I really like it.
We're going to stop, no more cutting, so drag it out to the edge. We'll just gather up, get all the tools in, and then we'll have to drag all the stuff down.
Right, Oscar, mm-hmm. I've pulled you aside while everyone's dragging their pine trees down the hill. Are you glad not to be doing that? Or?
Yeah.
So what drew you to be part of this group?
Well, I'm not doing it for Duke of Edinburgh or anything. I'm too young, but...
How old are you?
I'm 12, about to be 13, so just... love nature, so yeah.
And have you always loved nature, or is it a recent thing?
I feel like from lockdown I really had the time to go outside and things, and by the fields around my house and my town. Yeah, I've sort of fallen in love with it. I like coming out and doing art, or just helping be more eco-friendly and things like that.
And so what difference do you feel you're making by being part of this group, would you say?
Well, it really feels like it's just really helping, and the fact that you're doing this is providing for these animals that would go extinct if they didn't have this.
And do you have friends who aren't into nature?
Yeah, I mean, I have friends that, like, wouldn't go on a walk if I asked them to. And, like... you know, really just think they're missing out. Like, because they don't have these experiences, they just don't know this is here. And it's like outstanding natural beauty, and they just don't see it, and I really wish they could. Yeah. It's just a small group of us here, but with more people, we could be doing so much more to help, so I just really want people to join.
So I'm now on Ashdown Forest with Rich Skrine, who is described by other outdoor educators as exceptional in in his work in the outdoors with children and adults. And Rich is a forest school teacher trainer, and he's also written three books: 50 Things to Do in the Wild, 50 Things to Do with a Stick, and 50 Things to Do in the Snow. So thank you for coming, Rich.
Oh, my pleasure. Delighted to be sat on this birch log with you.
So, well, let's start by hearing where your passion for nature came from.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny one because, you know, although my mum was really into gardening, we weren't campers or that much of an outdoorsy family. And I must admit that I took a funky route into my love of nature. And the thing that originally took me to some really wild places in my early 20s was actually parties, raves, you know, these kind of big old sound systems on a beach, in a forest, on a piece of land somewhere, and we would drive out to these remote places. And I remember after a while turning around and saying, this would be better without all these people. It would be better without this loud music. But I'd seen where they were, so we'd go back there. And then these weekends away adventuring and finding these wild spots, that became a sanctuary, that became a medicine. And eventually I was able to connect that with my work.
Gosh, that's, as you just say, a funky route in. Well, a friend who works outdoors with nursery school children was saying to me that the great thing is when children don't have any toys, and they aren't actually even given any activities, they can really just get immersed in their play and have very few conflicts because they're not fighting over things. There's an abundance of leaves and twigs. So what have you found about that with children in nature, how they respond to being in nature?
Well, first off, let's start with the humble stick, shall we? The greatest toy in the world that can be an ambulance, a magic wand, a sword. In a classroom, a crayon has a limited number of uses. But out here in nature, the stick, the leaf, and all the loose parts, all these loose materials out here, have a literally infinite number of possibilities for play and for imagination. I must say as well that as someone who works a lot in an urban context, when I'm talking about wild places, I'm both speaking of ancient woodlands and scrubby little parklands in the middle of London, where I also work. I think it's really important to recognise the magic and the escape that can happen on both.
So can you describe to me a typical session, let's say with primary school children or secondary school children?
Well, the beauty of it is that there is no typical session, of course. Primary school sessions are learner-centred, which means that everybody can follow their own interests. Now, that goes as much for the participants as it does for the leaders. And I would say a good leader will not necessarily be found issuing instructions and being a major part of all the play, exploration and learning that's happening, but they might be crouched over in the corner getting on with something, getting excited by something themselves. That means that when the learners look up and have a look around and they see their adults busying and beavering away, that gives them either the permission to carry on with whatever they're doing, or it might pique their interest and they might go over and ask them what they're doing.
And of course the irony these days is, whereas a few decades ago when children were left to their own devices, they were left to their own devices, and now when they're left to their own devices, they're on their devices. So what kind of battle have you had? I mean, obviously you've already got them outdoors most of the time, but how much do you see the fact that they've often been on screens? How do you see that playing out when they're outdoors?
So often when I go in to meet a group to explain what we're going to be doing out in the woods, and that might be a residential trip not far from here, and then when I explain to them that they can't bring their phones and that there's no computers or Wi-Fi there, that this will be a screen-free holiday, we'll always get the same, oh, what? But I can tell you that in all of my years of doing this, not once has any child ever asked for their screen or their phones or their computers. Now, they're grateful to get back to it when they get home, and that's absolutely fine. But they need the release from these screens as much as we do as adults.
What do you think the barrier is to parents getting kids out of the house more?
The most important thing to help a child to enjoy, or a teenager to enjoy a walk, is to go at their pace. If you can slow to their pace, which may be excruciating, then you'll probably find that they can walk for a long, long time.
And for the parent who is anxious when the child is climbing higher and higher up the tree, how do you get the balance right?
We as a culture seem to have become far more risk averse. The Forest School approach really prioritises appropriate risk. How about asking them, are you safe? So rather than say, get down, and rather than expressing your fears, which are legitimate, how about asking, are you safe? And you'll probably find they'll pause, they'll look up and down, they'll check in with themselves, and they'll either say, no, I don't feel safe, and they'll start coming down, or they'll say, I'm good, I'm going to keep going.
It's so simple. And what about the barriers to some people, some cultures even, to feel welcome outdoors?
Yeah, I'm really glad you phrase it like that, because many communities don't feel welcome in natural spaces. They don't necessarily see people who look like them, and they don't necessarily feel like it's for them. One beautiful outcome of Forest School programs that I've run in the past is that the children and young people will tell me, I brought my uncles here on the weekend. I brought them to see the forest. Or I brought my mum here. I brought my granny here.
That's having had the session with you.
Precisely. So having been through the programme with us and the children and young people themselves feeling a sense of ownership, stewardship, a relationship with that space, they then introduce their families to it. So the ripples of that work spreads out into the community beyond.
And what about, like, so say there isn't even a bit of scrubby parkland nearby, but we're just talking about nature in the home, literally spiders in the bath or daddy long legs. Do you think we need to kind of work on even how we treat the creepy crawlies in our home?
Absolutely. What is this work if it isn't slowing down and looking? And what could be more awe-inspiring than watching spider spin her web on the windowsill?
So your books, 50 things to do in the wild, 50 things to do with a stick, and 50 things to do in the snow. They're largely bushcraft skills, and there's beautiful illustrations and as few words as you can to just entice children and adults to get making and get creating in the outdoors. How responsive do you find the children are to make these things? Because they all look like they involve a lot of patience.
Children are as susceptible to the thrill of creation as humans of all sizes are. And I've found that the joy of many of these activities is that they're practical and you're making things, but they also ask you to slow down. So for example, whittling a spoon, right? It certainly takes a lot of patience. Might have to work through a bit of frustration, but you're also going to intimately get to know the tree that you're working with, the wood that you're working with, get to know the wood grain, get to understand the tool that you're working with. You also might find that whilst your hands are busy, whilst you're working on your spoon and creating a mountain of shavings around your feet, that you have time to think and process things.
And how have you found that people have used your books? What have you found have been their response to how much they've got stuck in?
My favourite thing is to see a book that is absolutely destroyed, that is muddy, that is torn, that's burnt at the edges, that's held together with gaffer tape, and that's been out there on some adventures. That's my absolute favourite thing, and that says it all.
Okay, lovely. So you gave some tips to parents about how to entice their teenagers out. What do you do when you've got secondary school children in a group and some of them are just very much in the whatevs mode and you can see that you've got to light them up to get them engaged?
They will be expressing a need, and very often there'll be a way to get past that. And that might be to get them around the fire, that might be to get cooking, that might be to get building, that might be to give them a job, that might be to give them space.
I can imagine that fire is one of your biggest tricks up your sleeve, because most people aren't exposed to outdoor fires that often. So I think for a teenager there's a sense of slight anarchy about the fire in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shame that it's so amazing and awe-inspiring to a young person, and indeed to an adult, to sit around a fire in 2024. It's a beautiful thing to be able to introduce to teenagers.
Thank you so much, Rich. But before we let you go, we have these wildlife interludes in the podcast where we hand a bit of time over to the natural world. Is there a sound that you would particularly like to play after your interview?
I'd like to offer you the creaking of trees as you walk through the woods, the almost conversational creaking of these great giants that we walk amongst as we walk through the Ashdown Forest. It's early spring, it's a cold night,
We're high up on a hill in the Ashdown Forest, overlooking the South Downs in the distance and the twinkling lights of the towns and villages away from us. I've heard some exciting reports from this part of the forest that where last year one pair of lapwings tried to breed, there are now four birds here that are setting up territories and displaying over the forest during the daytime. Right now, they're going to be tucked up in the heather, roosting. We wanted to try and explore with a thermal imaging camera tonight to see if we could pick up any middle-ranking predators that might offer a threat to the lapwings. So we're going to do a thermal imaging sweep of the area where we think they're roosting and see what we see. And we are lucky tonight in that we have been joined by three young people who we have some special missions that they're going to help us with on this evening's dusk walk.
Thank you, Tom. And although we describe it as dusk, it's pretty pitch dark, really. Yeah. I would call this night walk rather than a dusk walk tonight.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And we have got with us...
I'm Dylan, and I'm 16 years old.
I'm Lucas, and I'm 17 years old.
I'm Aisha, and I'm 16 years old.
So, Tom, to up the game, has given each of you something to hold. Do you want to describe what you've each got?
A UV torch. Yeah.
I have a very expensive thermal imaging camera.
I've got a million candle power torch.
Million candles is basically a very strong torch.
Super bright. It illuminates up to a kilometre away, so it's got a big range on it.
Gosh. So, Tom, what's the plan?
So we're going to fire up the thermal imaging camera. And we're going to pan across the open heath here and see if we can pick up any heat signatures and interpret what wildlife is active at this time of night. So, break out the very expensive thermal imaging camera, Aisha.
Of course.
Is this your first time you've looked through a thermal imaging camera?
It is.
Yeah, tell us what you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, out in the distance, I think it's in some sort of field or like heathland. You can see loads of tiny little clusters of these red dots. Which, I don't know, they could be rabbits.
Yeah, well, if they're fields, compare the red dots to the size of the trees nearby. Oh, yeah. That's a massive herd of fallow deer.
There's so many.
In the old lodge field, so they're all eating grass. There's something there.
You can see them.
What happens if you pan a little bit closer to within, you know, 100 metres or so of where we're standing, over the heather and the gorse, and see if you're picking up any little hot spots?
Yeah, I can see tiny... Well, it's obviously closer. I'm assuming it's some, I don't know, fox or something.
Okay.
But it's moving.
Towards us?
Right.
Along. Quite, like, little movements, but...
I think this might be the moment we'll get Luca to use the torch. And if you line up your torch, Luca, with where she's looking at the camera and put it on, see if we get any eye shine. Just move it really slowly.
Can't see anything anymore.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's probably ducked for cover. We've been standing around chatting, so anything that might have been here that was worried about a human presence could well have moved off. But I did also check as soon as we arrived, and there was no obvious fox or badger activity here. So that's a possible thumbs up for the ground nesting lapwings, because if they find a nest with some nice warm eggs in them, that's dinner sorted.
Right, should we do some stomping?
Yes.
Yes, right.
Let's stomp.
Can I buy this one? Right, we're going to hand over to Dylan and get him to put his UV torch on now. Let's see what happens if we pan that torch through the heather, the moor grass and the gorse.
Have you ever used one of these before?
Not out in nature, no. Only with invisible ink as a kid.
What we're hoping to try and detect in some things is biofluorescence. To just challenge what we think we know of things. And biofluorescence is different from bioluminescence, and bioluminescence is when living things are actually able to emit light.
So would a glowworm be?
So a glowworm is an example of bioluminescence. Oh, what have you got, Dylan?
Oh, it's a little bright red thing on a piece of heather.
Oh, yeah. What? Oh, yeah, look at that. Whoa. But what is it?
I don't know.
Minuscule, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looks like it's actually...
Like
a match has just lit it, doesn't it?
It looks like an ember.
Yeah, an ember. On a bit of heather. Actually, they almost look like insect eggs.
Actually, that
could be fungus, couldn't it?
Well spotted.
Right, bigger target this time. Nettles shine up bright red, by the way, so...
Lucas, shine your torch.
The lichen on the pine sapling.
Changes colour.
Yeah, it goes bright red. Is that like nettles?
That's really cool.
That is
Why does it brilliant. Do that? The wavelength of
it
the light.
It changes the wavelength, yeah. And reflects back a different colour. From powder green to a deep sort of rusty red.
What do you got? Well, it just kind of shows up kind of brighter, some lichen.
Yeah, exactly.
Type.
Oh no, hang on. That is, give that a sniff. I think that is
bird droppings.
Pine resin.
Pine resin.
Yeah, there's something.
Oh yeah, it's fungal hyphae that are showing up electric blue. Wow.
Okay. Look at that.
Yeah.
I mean, right. It is deep, deep red.
Yeah, and what happens, let's just, Luca, if you turn the bright torch on a second, let's just see what it looks like in normal light. And I think that is moss. Try shining it on that, turn the normal light off.
Oh my god, look at that.
Gotta get a picture.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it almost looks like lava.
I've never seen anything like that in nature. No. Have any of you?
No.
No.
So Tom, what do you think the role is of this biofluorescence?
Well,
If it has one.
There have been some studies on blue tits that show that female blue tits that reflect UV light are more attractive to the males, and it's a sign of breeding vigour. So more UV reflected, better breeding success. In mycelium, I don't know. You know, the fungi don't see each other in a visual sense. So
As far as we know,
yeah. In a kind of, they've got eyes to see each other sense. So reflecting those kind of spectrums of light, does that help them? I don't know.
Might just be incidental.
It might be incidental. So it feels to me like we've opened our eyes up to a whole spectrum of stuff that we would otherwise have missed were it not for these UV rays.
My takeaway is we got a lot more fun out of the £15 UV torch than the £3,000 thermal imaging camera. I don't know, what did you all think?
I think it was really cool to be able to walk around in the pitch dark with this little blue torch and seeing all these different colours that like just don't exist when you're just looking with your bare eyes. And also it was so quiet, it was quite an unusual experience, especially on a school night.
Like Aisha, it was a great experience to see how different organisms shone in the UV light.
The UV light was very, very cool. Like, you never see anything like glowing pink in nature, do you? With the UV light, it's suddenly there. It's just like, yeah, it's really cool.
So any other takeaways from tonight? Does it make you want to do a bit of night prowling?
Definitely.
Yeah, night walks, I always forget how amazing they are.
Same as Lucas and Aisha. Should do more of them.
Okay, everyone, thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
So Tom, looking back over the programme, it strikes me that the key ingredients for connecting children to nature are curiosity and enthusiasm.
Without a doubt, they are my two tools in my box when I'm trying to communicate with children and adults.
So like never losing that maybe under this log excitement.
It's curiosity for a lifetime, and it's an open book with any number of pages, as long as you've got the beans for it, you know? And fortunately, I haven't run out. I never run out. I move from thing to thing, you know, sometimes it's plants and sometimes it's hoverflies and sometimes it's dragonflies, but it keeps going.
Well, that really echoes a quote by Albert Einstein, which I just came across. There are two ways to live your life. One is though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle.
I know which camp I'm in.
To me, that really is what this is about.
Like, totally.
Treating everything as a miracle. So I think if a child is at the stage of nature's boring and it's a struggle to get them to go for a walk, don't despair. Just keep...
Never. Don't give up and always lead by example.
So show, don't tell.
Show, don't tell, yep.
And actually, I am reminded that I hated going for walks as a child and now it's really the main thing I want to do.
And you're not alone. The number of people I meet who say exactly the same thing, and they almost have trauma around these long walks that they're dragged on, even in the rain, but it's now their solace, the place they go.
We're extremely grateful to three charities for their support. Firstly, the Titcomb Foundation for funding this episode.
Also, the Friends of Ashdown Forest, which funds the education programme on the forest and got behind this episode.
And the Ashdown Forest Foundation, known as TAF, for helping our fundraising.
Before we go, we just wanted to mention that Sam Lee, the folk musician, is starting another run of his Singing with Nightingale evenings in Sussex from April through to May. And if you'd like to book, then just go to singingwithnightingales.co.uk.
And if you like folk music, then do try out the podcast Folk on Foot, which will be trailed at the end of this episode. Like our podcast, it's all recorded outdoors. So that's all for now. Our next episode will be out in the summer. Goodbye until then.
Goodbye.
I'm Matthew Bannister. On my award-winning podcast, Folk on Foot, we travel the length and breadth of the UK and Ireland, taking you to the most extraordinary places.
The ancient pagan Celts used to call places like Sandwood thin places, places where the distance between heaven and earth was very short.
As we walk and talk with the finest folk musicians, you'll be immersed in landscape, history, and the natural world.
In English lore, the curlew is one of the seven whistlers, along with the golden plover, which is another bird you would hear here. Here he comes, gosh, he's so close. Amazing.
And recorded in each location, there is always beautiful, transcendent music.
Would you search through the loamy earth for me? Climb through the briar and bramble.
There are more than 60 glorious episodes of Folk on Foot for you to discover wherever you get your podcasts. So start your escape into our world now.